Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control. Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control now. Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control. Johnny's got a problem, he's out of control. Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control. Got static on the brain, out of control now. Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control.
What is the band, the Feelies?
What is the band?
Yeah.
To me personally, I just see it as being a unique band that I can't think of too many other bands that I say, well, they sound like the Feelies. I think the Feelies, you know, it may not be the greatest band, but I think it's got a unique sound that I don't hear other bands in. I mean, I certainly hear the influences of bands that have had on the Feelies. Like I say, the Velvet Underground, Eno, Modern Lovers, Stooges. But I've never heard a band that sounds like the Feelies. So I think it's like a totally unique band that has its own sound. I mean, it may not be the sound that translates into millions of record sales like a Fleetwood Mac or somebody like that, or an R.E.M., but it's, you know, got its own place.
Hello, and welcome to the seventh episode of Jughead's Basement, featuring the 1986 release of the Feelies' second full-length record, The Good Earth. Released on Coyote Records, a label founded by Steve Fallon, owner of the legendary Hoboken, New Jersey club, Maxwell's, a venue that helped the fledgling careers of not only the Feelies, but hundreds of others, including R.E.M., Yola Tango, The Minutemen, The Replacements, Fugazi, and my very own band, Screeching Weasel. The Feelies formed in 1976, and the members, with only slightly shifting personnel, have consistently played together to this very day, 37 years later, and yet they have only released 5 records to date. The Feelies' driving yet calm pace, apparent in the music, is so perfectly intertwined with the way in which the band functions and perceives itself, and I hope this podcast can give you a glimpse into this nature. Each band member's willingness to participate on this podcast was amazing in itself, but more importantly, it reveals the deep level of passion and commitment intrinsic to each individual's otherwise wildly varying characteristics. They are kind at heart, yet private. Highly influential and influenced, yet totally unique. Personable, yet distant. Extremely talented, yet meticulously simple in their approach to music and melody. Without hesitation, I say they are my favorite band of all time. On this podcast, you will hear sections of a few extended interviews of all 5 members of the Feelies: singer-guitarist Glenn Mercer, second guitarist Bill Million, bassist Brenda Sauter, drummer Stan Demeski, and of course on percussion, Dave Weckerman. And as always, these interviews will be interspersed with original pieces. A few of my good friends have spent much time contemplating the effect of The Good Earth on their lives, and they have all chosen specific songs that spoke directly to them. These pieces, first and foremost, are each writer's individual takes on how a specific song has inspired them. You will hear truths, fictions, personal tales, lyrical analytics, and biographies. And also, as always, this program will be dictated by the order of the songs that appear on the album that is being featured. And now, with no further ado, The Good Earth. The name Feelies came from a novel, Brave New World, by Aldous Huxley. What struck you about Huxley's word Feelies, and has this word choice somewhat affected the perception or sound of the band, ultimately?
Actually, it was really an idea that wasn't with a lot of like great thought. It just seemed to be a good name for a band. It kind of popped in my head, and it fit. What the Feelies are in the book are obviously like a multidimensional concept where you can feel the emotion of, I guess in that case, like film. It just seemed to fit. Nothing more than that.
Sometimes there isn't a very good answer, but sometimes
you know, people really think of the title, and sometimes it's the name The Feelies. It's a feeling you get.
It's a good point, because with the name of the band and with a lot of things that we do, it's just things that just, you know, I think it happens with a lot of people. You pick up on something very quickly. The cover of our last album was on our engineer's laptop in the studio, and it kind of almost collectively caught everyone's eye as everyone walked into the room. Everyone said, wow, what's that? But it was just one of those things that we didn't labor over an album cover. It just, wow, that pretty cool photo. And that's pretty much how it works a lot of the times.
Is it hard to play someone else's song?
Yes. Yeah, basically.
I would say not. You know, you always hope that you're doing what they have in mind. And, you know, there's a lot of, I think with the band, there's a lot of intuition where you kind of feed off of each other's part. And there's this sort of magic when everything is clicking and running smoothly like that.
You and Glenn Mercer have been working together for quite a long time. Some are at least around, I think, like 36 years at least. How did you meet?
Well, we were both, you know, pretty much, I grew up in like a suburban area. And I think at the time, it's right around the time that bands like the Stooges, the MC5, Modern Lovers, bands like that were just kind of coming around prior to that, the Velvet Underground. And I was out for a walk, and I heard, and I was like a big Stooges fan. My wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, we'd go pretty much anywhere to see the Stooges. I mean, probably saw them like 25 times, you know, in total. And more often than not, they would open up for the MC5, which was another big favorite band of ours. So walking down the street, and no one knew who these bands were, like in high school. I mean, they're just pretty much like non-existent for most people. And I heard I Want to Be Your Dog by the Stooges coming out of someone's garage. So I said, I got to go check this out. And it was Glenn. And so I introduced myself. And, you know, we found that we had so much in common musically. And one thing pretty much led to another. And we started the band. And the band, through, you know, a number of different musicians, evolved into, you know, over time, what we have today. So that's how I met Glenn. And we went to high schools that were separated by like this wooded area, and it's where pretty much like all the kids in high school would go to get high and just kind of hang out and skip class and everything. And right in the middle of this woods, like way back in the woods, was this like beeswax factory, and that's where the back cover of The Earth was shot. We thought it was kind of appropriate since it was this wooded area between both of our high schools.
First band you were in with Glenn Mercer and Bill Million was the OutKids. Who did you meet first of the two, and what were the circumstances of that meeting?
Well, actually, I met Glenn first. We were actually scabs. We worked at a place called Two Guys, which was a big department store of the day, and we were scabs when the other people were on strike. After the strike was over, Glenn got fired, but for some reason they kept me on. And then I didn't see Glenn for like a year, and a mutual friend of ours, a drummer named Billy Morrison, was quitting this band from Halden, and he said, well, maybe you'll be interested in playing with them. So I called this number, not knowing I was talking to Glenn, and I went to band practice, and lo and behold, it was Glenn from Two Guys. And Bill wasn't in the band then. It was another bass player and a singer named Rich Riley, and we started as the OutKids playing, you know, it was that fine line between glam and punk, you know, 74, 75. Punk hadn't really hit yet, but we were kind of punky, a little bit glammy. And then the bass player, this guy Bob, he quit to become a night manager at Kentucky Fried Chicken, and Bill came in on bass. So now it was me, Bill, Glenn, and the singer, Rich Riley. And we continued as the OutKids. We got some really good shows. We like opened up for bands like Suicide and Wayne County. You know, they were like kind of pre-punk bands of New York, but they had a following, so we got exposure. The Ramones actually came and saw us one night and told us we were good. but we should get rid of the singer. The singer and I actually got into a fight on stage at a club in New York. He hit me with a cymbal and I punched him, and then he quit. So it was just me, Bill, and Glenn left as a power trio. And Glenn started singing, and then Bill wanted to switch to guitar. So we got another bass player, this guy named Junior. That's all we remember him as, Junior. And Bill came up with the name The Feelies, because, you know, the Out Kids sounded a little dated. And, you know, New Wave was coming on with the Talking Heads and these oddball kind of names. And Glenn started and Bill started coming up with original songs. The whole style of drumming was changed. Like, you know, I wasn't allowed to hit cymbals much and play more like Maureen Tucker, you know, more tribal on the tom-toms. And, I was fine with that. And I liked the direction the band was moving in. And I think we played our first show. It was Memorial Day weekend. That began the whole, you know, playing on holidays kind of tradition. It was 1976, the year of the bicentennial.
The Good Earth, I've always said, is a great driving record, driving in its cohesiveness and melodic similarity of songs, but also literally a great record to listen to while driving.
Oh, definitely, yeah, because we had done a cross-country tour in 1984. You know, I don't know if they told you a whole story about that, you know, in a motorhome that broke down about five times. From Glenn's standpoint as a songwriter, a lot of the songs that ended up on The Good Earth came from that experience of driving cross-country, like seeing certain things. A lot of the words and imagery in those songs are from the traveling, like burning cars out on the highway is actually something we saw on the trip. And I think probably, I mean, I've never really asked them about this, but the REM's early songs, they toured, you know, incessantly. And I'm sure a lot of their songs were influenced by what they saw on the road and stuff. So it's like, you know, it's just things that happen simultaneously, but we weren't really influenced. Like, I don't remember anybody even listening to REM back then, you know? Like, the touring of America definitely influenced those songs. I mean, I could sense that without even having to ask Glenn about it.
Well, I think all of our records make great records to drive to. You know, I've heard that from a lot of people, and I kind of agree with that. With that record, yeah, like, you know, I had said earlier about that trip cross country, so spending a month on the road probably had something to do with that. Fits in there somewhere.
Were you writing those guitar lines while you were on the road?
No, I don't really, you know, find it conducive to writing. But it was more like when you get back, because then you're kind of on that wavelength of performing and, you know, constantly on the move. So then when you get home, it's like you're stationary and you got a lot of momentum, so you tend to, like, work that out into songs.
My name is Jim Testa, and I'm going to talk about a Philly song called The High Road. The High Road is from the Philly's second album, The Good Earth. Now, I came along to the Maxwell's Hoboken scene about 1980, so I just missed the first incarnation of the Feelies. They had been playing around the CBGB's punk rock circuit in the late 70s. In 1980, they released Crazy Rhythms, their amazing debut album, and then they kind of disappeared. And by the time I started hanging out and became a regular at Maxwell's, everybody knew the Feelies, and they'd hang out there. You'd see Glenn Mercer there all the time, looking like a rock star, always wearing his shades, a long-sleeve shirt unbuttoned halfway to the waist, showing off that skinny, pale chest. He looked like a rock star. Of course, the fact of the matter is that all of us at Maxwell's, the Bongos and the Individuals and the other bands and Newman Switchboard and Maxwell's owner, Steve Fallon, We treated the Feelies like demigods because they were the biggest thing in our little scene, but the album hadn't sold well at all and got played a little bit on FM radio, but it really was a commercial failure, and the Feelies had pretty much stopped playing out. The original bass player and drummer had moved on to other things, and they started playing in all these weird side projects like the Tripes and Young Woo. But then, every once in a while, the Feelies would get back together again and they'd play out on the 4th of July or a holiday. And finally, Steve Fallon, whose family owned Maxwell's, and Steve was the one who booked the bands there, Steve talked the band into giving it another shot. And as early as 1983, the band had reconstituted itself with Brenda Sauter on bass and Stanley Demeski on drums. And they started playing shows again, and then Steve finally cajoled them into recording a new album for his label, Coyote Records. And it was called The Good Earth, and it came out in 1986. Steve Fallon became the Feelies' manager, and they actually started playing out quite a bit and even touring, and they recorded two more albums after that. But for me, The High Road is one of my favorite songs. It sort of represents everything I love the band. It has that psychedelic, absolutely mesmerizing, drony pop jangle that they got from the Velvet Underground. And it has those concise one-note Glenn Mercer solos. And the just ethereal background vocals that almost sound more like one of the instruments. And this just wonderful beat that stays in your head. It's an absolutely hypnotizing song, and I just never get tired of hearing it. There were a couple of songs about driving on The Good Earth. There was another one called Let's Go that actually wound up getting used in a Volvo commercial. Probably more people heard the Feelies from that than any of their records. But for me, The Good Earth is where the Feelies kind of came back and reminded me of why I love them so much. It's just a great song, one that I never get tired of listening to.
Crazy Rhythms came out in 1980, and then about 5 years later, Good Earth is released, and there you are. But of course you didn't just appear, or did you? Bring me up to speed on the chain of events that led to you joining and recording with the Feelies.
I'm pretty much from the same area. I mean, those guys were based in the Haledon area, which is right by Paterson. I grew up mostly in Lyndhurst. My family's from Jersey City, and I grew up mostly in Lyndhurst, which is by the Meadowlands, by Giant Stadium. I got my first drum when I was 9. I actually started learning how to play, I guess, when I was 10. And then, you know, I just always wanted to be a musician. So, for what it's worth, I went to college for music education, although I didn't get my degree, but I took basically all my music courses and, you know, played in a lot of percussion ensemble and stuff like that. And I was playing in a bunch of bands, playing in cover bands mostly with my friends. And Lyndhurst had a lot of musicians back then, it seemed. And Lou Reed was real big in Lyndhurst. People like David Bowie, you know, the Glitter stuff. And, you know, people were into, like, the Grateful Dead and stuff like that, too. But, you know, the cover bands I played in, we tried to play songs that we could actually kind of sound like. In 78, we started trying originals, and then, like, 79 and 1980, I guess, by 1980, we went all original, because that was when, you know, the punk rock new wave thing. It was pretty silly trying to, you know, work in a cover band. You know, we just couldn't sound like Bruce Springsteen very well. I just sort of happened upon the Feelies basically because an article in the New York Rocker. I had heard their name before that. I had seen it like in the papers, like playing CBGBs, but it didn't really strike me as a band I wanted to seek out actively. But then I read this New York Rocker article where, I mean, they had a picture in back of Bill's house, which is, you know, a couple blocks from where I live now. And, you know, it was like pretty much the guys who lived next door to me that were playing in bands and, you know, making valid original music. And also that, you know, they had a lot of drums involved, a lot of drums and percussion, because at that time I was in college and I was pretty much doing the heavy duty studying of drums and percussion. Steve Fallon at one point mentioned that Anton had left the band and that they needed a drummer, so of course I opened my mouth because at that point I was always looking for opportunities to better my playing position and, you know, just move forward. And I guess in the summer of 81, I went and auditioned. It was pretty much the Crazy Rhythms band without Anton. It was Bill, Glenn, Dave, and Keith. The bass player from Crazy Rhythms. And while I wasn't able to really walk in and just play the Crazy Rhythms stuff right off the bat, you know, to the way Anton had done it, I was willing to experiment and take direction.
Leading up to meeting the Feelies, I was going to art school in New Jersey, met a fellow classmate. We became pretty good friends, and she was friends with the woman who would eventually become Stan's wife. She is John Baumgartner's sister, Janice. That was the connection to meeting first the Tripe. I just fell in love with the sound of the band. So I'd go to see them, you know, whenever they played, which was not too often, kind of like the Feelies. I was going to give bass lessons to Janice, and she changed her mind, and sort of to make up to me, the Tripe offered that I could just jam with them, and I took up the offer. And then after a couple times of jamming with them, I worked up the nerve to say, you know, if you ever wanted a bass player, I would love to join. And it took several months. Then John called and said, would you like to join the band? At that point, Bill was in the band playing percussion. Stan was on drums. Glenn took guitar. John, Tony, and Mark in the band. The thing with those Halden bands was that they didn't have a bass player. So it was like a field day for a bass player. If things worked out well, there were these other bands who needed bass players as well. So via Tripe, then I joined Young Woo, because Young Woo didn't have a bass player. John on his Farfisa had basically been supplying like the bottom end to the song, including Young Woo. And then also the Willies, and the Willies were really basically the Feelies lineup. It was more like instrumental and ambient type music, not your typical Feelies type. So the Willies eventually became the Feelies, and we had started doing some Feelies songs, like some covers, some ambient type music, and the Willies just kind of segued right to the Feelies, and that was definitely by like 1984.
To an audience member, it sometimes feels like the Tripes and the Willies just sort of magically became the Feelies. But like what you're saying, it's sort of a progression. But was there a moment, because since the Feelies had already been a band before, was there a moment where someone just said, hey, let's just do this under the Feelies?
I'm remembering a conversation probably during a practice where Bill and Glenn said, we're thinking of becoming the Feelies again. To me, that was a little bit of a surprise because I don't think I thought that much into the future about what the Willies would become. I thought that was fine with me, and I was perfectly content with that group. So when they said that, okay, we're going to be becoming the Feelies, I mean, that was just great. And I don't think I thought of coming. I thought that the groups would always remain separate. And I probably thought, well, if anything, you know, maybe they'll get back with the original members or something, but didn't think that I would be included ultimately in the Feelies.
Charlie's a mild-mannered executive who's never been far from home. Now Lulu's taking him all the way.
I'm Lulu.
Charles, pleased to meet you.
I've never done anything like this before.
Don't worry, Charlie, I have.
I mean, look straight, you know, but right down in here, that's where it counts. Deep down, I got what it takes.
If you were my mother and I brought this guy home as my husband, what would you think?
Very nice. But, I'd get rid of those handcuffs if I were you.
Something wild.
There is this silence that you play with, like in your music, in the shows, that I think is so interesting. And a lot of people say it was very different from what was going on. A lot of music was immediate back then. I'm just trying to get at the core of what is that? Or is that something that was intentional for you? you know, between songs or the slow building of songs?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, a lot of people think that there's big spaces on Crazy Rhythms, but it was really, I guess it was underestimating the fidelity of vinyl at the time, so you really kind of can't hear it. And the co-producer said, well, you got to turn it up. Nobody's going to hear it. And we said, no, no, it sounds fine. We don't want to overdo it. But he was right. You really can't hear it. But there are sounds in those spaces. And then when we play live, you know, it's just we want to make sure we're in tune. And I guess the pacing is sort of something beyond your control. Yeah, we start a song when we're ready sort of thing. We're not like big show business kind of a band. People would want to introduce the band. We said, well, you know, that's kind of cliche and corny. Unnecessary. They know who we are. You don't have to say, ladies and gentlemen, here are the Feelies. So we said, well, we'll take it a step further. Not only won't we have an introduction, but we'll make it so that people won't know when the set is starting. Like, it'll vary throughout the crowd and the time, and start out with little clawed-ache clicks and clacks and gradually fade in the guitar. And yeah, it was great because the people in the front would kind of catch on, and then you'd kind of be able to tell that a little further back you'd catch it a little later, and gradually, you know, fade in with the drums, and everybody knows you're starting the song, starting to set it. But, you know, it was kind of playing with the idea of, you know, starting it at randomness to it. But one, two, three, four, here it is. It's like, kind of piece it together as it fades in.
The song Slipping, parentheses, into something, unparentheses, from The Good Earth was featured in the movie Something Wild, featuring Jeff Daniels and Melanie Griffith, a great vehicle for both those actors at the time. The song is prominently placed in the movie, but the band also makes an appearance, but is credited for the appearance under the name The Willies. Why was it called The Willies?
Well, that was Jonathan's idea. We actually recorded it, or filmed it, with the MC saying, let's hear it for The Feelies. And then I guess in the editing, or when they watched the dailies, he had the thought, well, it doesn't really make sense that this band, real band, the Feelies, would be performing at this function. You know, he just put a weird perspective on it. That didn't think it rang true in the scene, so to speak. So we said, well, we do have this offshoot band. It's called the Willies. And he said, oh, it's perfect. We'll put that in. So they actually dubbed that in later.
How did the band end up with a song and an appearance in the movie?
Well, our friendship with Jonathan Demme goes back to right after Crazy Rhythms came out. We flew out to Los Angeles to play some shows, and he saw us playing at the Whiskey Go-Go. And shortly after that, he was in New York, and he called and introduced himself, and he said he was a big fan of the band and the record, and thought maybe we could work on something, maybe throw him a concert. So he arranged for a screening of The Last Waltz.
Oh, it's not like it used to be.
A Virgil Caine is the name, and I served on the Danville train.
We went to New York and met him at the theater and watched the movie, talked a little bit about that movie in particular and what Scorsese did, and you know, just how he was a fan of that film and fan of the band, and just came up with the idea of The Night of the Living Feelies, which would be a concert film with us performing, and then the audience would kind of slowly kind of drift through the town, almost like in a zombie-like state, until they got to the venue, and then they would become rejuvenated after seeing the band. So, you know, seemed like a wacky kind of idea, but, you know, kind of made sense in a way. You know, especially knowing that he had worked with Roger Corman, just seemed like could be kind of almost tongue-in-cheek or whatever. But he couldn't really raise the money to finance it. So I guess the movie he went on to make stopped making sense. That had more of a backing from the record label. So, you know, we kept in touch over the years. And when the movie part came up, one of us and called and asked, and we said, sure, we'll do it. So flew down to Florida, and 4 or 5 days later, wrapped up the scene. Jonathan Demme was looking
for a certain set of songs that he wanted us to play, and we tried a number of them. One was the Rocky theme, but he wanted this like really fast rave up version of it, and we did that, and he had heard it, and I think ultimately Sylvester Stallone, who controls the rights to the song, wouldn't allow it to be used. I guess he's pretty guarded about it. But we did like take it to the limit. I guess eventually we did some songs, and we actually improvised some things on the set. I think I'm a Believer, you know, we suggested to him, and he liked the idea. He liked the idea of Fame, which Dave sang in the film. It's a reunion scene for the class of 1976. It takes place in 1986, so it's a 10th anniversary reunion. Glenn felt uncomfortable trying to sing it and play the guitar, because, you know, it's not our style. It's funky. So Jonathan Demme said, oh, what, Dave can sing it. It's not, you know, it's not really a song. You know, it's just like a, he just blurts out like, hey, you know. By this time was running out. We had to pick a song, and we didn't even think we could play Fame musically, but, you know, it came out okay. And then that's the funny part of the movie, because Jeff Daniels, who was the star, you know, he's got a moonwalk in that scene. So, if he's going to do the moonwalk, what better song than Fame to do it to? And it was funny watching him actually, you know, practice his moonwalk and everything. That's actually his feet doing it.
So we were kind of in the background in a way, but then when it came to that scene, realized like, wow, there's a lot that's kind of riding on our performance. In Jonathan's mind, he had Loveless Love as being the pivotal part of the movie where it suddenly gets dark, Ray Liotta shows up.
Hi, baby. Surprise.
And you know that things are, that the movie, you know, the climate of the movie is suddenly changing. You know, we were basically performing live in front of the audience there, and then when they do different shots, we would lip sync, but that was basically a live performance. When everything was done in that location, there was a party, and, you know, we just got to know people, some from the cast and some of the people working behind the scenes, and it was just a really great experience. I kept things pretty hush at work, like no one knew that I had gone away to make a movie except for like a good friend or two. And I don't know that anyone from work ever recognized me, but I mean, I've never really watched the show, but I hear that Hannah Montana, it's like, you know, similar to that, you know, she's in high school and then at night she's a rock star, I guess. And but yeah, not too many people knew.
There's only one song where I ended. I guess it's probably slipping into something. It's like I play it as long as I can, then when I get tired, I count it out to stop it.
They wanted to use the song in a soundtrack album, but because, like you said, the vocals are so low, it didn't fit with the other songs, according to the people involved, and they said, we got to remix it. We were on tour at the time, so we couldn't do it. They were going to have Roy Thomas Baker... I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he had done Queen and the Cars. And we just said, no, you know, we'd rather not have it on the album if it meant doing that. So it actually wasn't on the album.
For me, the absolute key track on the Feelies' second album is When Company Comes. Good Earth. You know, I was a Feelies fan. I was in the thick of my Feelies fandom as a young fanzine writer when The Good Earth came out. My buddy Jim Testa and I would travel anywhere in a 3 or 4 state area to see the Feelies play. We'd see them play at frat parties at Princeton University and up at Columbia University outside and at Maxwell's, of course, and CBGB and any place they ever played. But I gotta say, I loved the first album, Crazy Rhythms, more.
There's a kid I know, but not too well. Doesn't have a lot to say. Well, this boy lives right next door, and he has nothing to say.
Crazy Rhythms had this incredible mad scientist in their lair sound, which I don't think has ever been matched by any other record. The Good Earth is a brilliant album, don't get me wrong, but it sounded of the times. It sounded of the REM jangle and indie pop that characterized 1985, 86, 87. What I love about When Company Comes is it's the bridge between these two songs. This song dated back to the old Feelies with Anton Fear on drums and Keith D'Annunzio on bass. And it came out, you know, into their sets just after Crazy Rhythms. They played it for years, then they disappeared for several years. The most amazing Feelies show, and I've seen, I don't know, 150 Feelies show. The single most amazing Feelies show I ever saw was in a period where they came out of hibernation. Crazy Rhythms was long in the past. It's 1984 or so. And they played with Anton Fear on drums and Keith D'Annunzio on bass, as well as Stanley Domeski on drums and Brenda Sauter on bass. There were a lot of Feelies on stage. And I think, and I may be wrong, that they opened that night with When Company Comes, which made perfect sense. They were bidding farewell to the Crazy Rhythms Feelies, the old Feelies lineup, and saying, we are moving forward with this new Feelies lineup, which had been playing under the name The Willies. What was the difference between the Feelies and the Willies? These things are esoteric New Jersey trivia questions that only me and Jim Testa care about. Okay? Because the Feelies began writing new songs that sounded like Feelies songs, except they were 5 or 6 years down the line and they were a lot more jangly. When Company Comes is essentially an instrumental, although there are lyrics and vocals. But the vocals, a la Brian Eno, a la much of Crazy Rhythms, are buried so far back in the mix that they're indistinguishable. Now, I know the Feelies. I happen to know what the words are. Sit around, in the yard, where they are, where they go, when it's cold outside. That's pretty much it. Company comes to make you feel accepted. You do what the company wants to, asks for. Now, in typical Feelies fashion, I don't think this means anything. But the bridge that, between Crazy Rhythms and The Good Earth that reactivated the Feelies was a series of weeknight shows, one a week, for several months. I think it was all summer long, at a Haledon, New Jersey bar called the Peanut Gallery. There was nothing extraordinary about this bar. It was an old man's and sports fan kind of drinking bar. But the Feelies held a series of concerts, one a week, on a weeknight for several months, called Music for Neighbors. And this song, to me, is that anthem from that period. Company comes, you sit around in the yard, and you feel warm, even when it's cold outside, because you're with your friends, you're with your community. These are a group of people who went to high school together a million years ago now in Haledon, New Jersey, and they formed this lifelong bond of a musical aesthetic, of a personal friendship, of a way of viewing the world. It's a little weird if you're not part of the Feelies posse, and I was very close for several years. I played in Speed the Plow, which was a band of several Feelies offshoot people, marginal people. They had been in the Tripes, and Bill Million produced the album, and, you know, various Feelies, you know, in-laws were part of it, and, you know, but I was never a Feelie. I just wasn't from Haledon. I could go, and I could enjoy Music for Neighbors. I could go and be the company that came, but I would never be a Feelie. Whatever the special secret formula is, it's more mysterious than the Mason's Code, but they're special and wonderful people and an incredible band. And I love this song because it represents two eras of the band, two albums, and it's so easy to overlook on The Good Earth, but it's the standout for me.
The drumming in the Feelies, especially on Good Earth, is very solid, it's driving, intense, and yet there's sort of a calm and controlled feel to it. To me, this is a highly crucial element of the musical's philosophy of the band, and yet even though the drumming is intricate, it avoids being flashy. How does this style come about in you, and is it natural to your own aesthetic?
Yeah, that's pretty much the way I play, is not to overplay. You know, when I was growing up, you had a lot of guys who would just really overplay, like in cover bands and stuff, and it really turned me off. Also, in college, you learn how to get the most out of various components of the drum set, not to overuse things, how to play cymbals properly, you know, to get the best sound out of the drums. I'm a relatively shy person, too, so I don't really need to make grand flashy statements on the drums. I'm really into repetition. I was really influenced by the advent of drum machines. I didn't always like them, but I completely understood why they were replacing live drummers in many cases, because, you know, live drummers weren't always consistent or they were overplaying.
From the view outside of the band, it is often construed that Stan is the drummer and you're, in quotes, only a percussionist. Does this conception or misconception upset you in any way?
Well, the way I thought, playing the parts I play, I find greatly more challenging than just playing drums, you know, because the drum parts are, you know, they're fast, but with the percussion parts, you have to think about a lot more stuff. Like, you know, one song may have five different implements in it. Every show is challenging because if one little thing goes off, it can throw the whole rest of the band into chaos. And besides, if I didn't do it, somebody else would have to do it anyway. And it's like, it's one of the things that stand out about the band. I mean, yeah, we're not like a Bon Jovi kind of band with a prancing lead singer. It's like Stanley always refers to us as an ensemble, where it's not all about one thing. You know, it's like all the parts linked together. And he's quite correct in that assessment.
C, G, G, C, D. If I've picked up your guitar at any point over the past 27 years, that's what you would have heard me trying to play. The intro to Let's Go. Nowadays, that's as far as I can get. A few decades ago, I would have mangled my way through the rest of the song. Barely. Right now, you're hearing my 10-year-old son mangle his way through it. Within a week, he'll have it down. 5 years younger than I did. Well, I never really had it down. I was a wannabe singer who only bought a guitar in a failed attempt to control what songs my friends played during jams in the high school cafeteria after school. But I didn't have the ear that they had and struggled with a few songs they tried to teach me here and there. I was a sophomore in high school when I discovered the Feelies. They had just opened for REM at the Felt Forum. Most will remember the show for being cut short due to a girl passing out in the front row from the crush of the crowd. I remembered it for the whirling guitars and driving percussions of the opening act. Now, I say discovered in the same way Europeans claim to have discovered America. But up until then, practically everything that I listened to was on Maxell cassette tapes. 90-minute tapes of albums and CDs my older brother had already discovered. His main taste was British music, and he specialized in record labels. He had everything, and I mean everything, Factory Records ever put out. And it was in the midst of a Creation Records kick. At 15, I was at an age where I wanted to finally stake a claim in my own bands, my own labels. Some of my friends had already committed to the hardcore scene at CBGB's with the Sunday Matinee, but all that sweaty testosterone wasn't really my thing. Others had already found SST with Bad Brains, Sonic Youth, and the Minutemen.
I must look like a dork.
Later on, I would grab hold of Firehose, but in 1986, the odd tunings of Sonic Youth felt too much like homework. And while at the same time I was probably focusing my energies on the lyrics of Billy Bragg, the Jazz Butcher, and the Smiths, in a desire to find humor and meaning to my egocentric worldview, there was something about the guitars, percussions, and vocals, but not lyrics, of the Feelies. They put me in a trance and took me for a ride. The Good Earth was an album that I had to hear in its entirety every time. It, and later, for me, Crazy Rhythms, was in heavy rotation on my Walkman and became the soundtrack to my train and subway commute, walks through Central Park, and summer spent mowing lawns in New Jersey.
I'd add Yola Tango, Speed the Plow, and other Feely side projects to my vinyl collection and thus laid claim to my own label, Coyote Records. Maybe it was my New Jersey roots that made them seem my own, although my eventual trips to Maxwell's weren't via the Parkway or the Turnpike, but the PATH train from Manhattan where I went to high school. Over the next few years, while seeing the Feelies headline their own shows, Maxwell's is where I had my concert highlight. That's where during one of her many walks to and from the stage between encores, Brenda stopped to stare at the t-shirt I was wearing. It had the album cover from XTC's Skylarking. I don't recall her comment as much as her fixed gaze at the flute-playing couple. Years and years and years later, I'd catch them in Chicago's Grant Park and their energy was as enthralling as ever. They held up as well as the Good Earth itself, an album I upgraded onto CD, and then was my first purchase in its entirety on iTunes. And now, my son is playing the crisp, clean chords, doing his best to catch up to their frenetic strumming. He'd probably rather be playing something by Mumford & Sons or Fun, but until he's old enough to truly discover his own bands, I'll force my musical hegemony on him. All night long.
First, I'll say I'm not happy with the phrasing of this next question. It sounds kind of clunky and a bit naive. Does being the only woman in the band have any effect on the dynamics of the band? Ultimately, I'm interested in if you have experienced any struggle in the music industry that you can pinpoint to being somehow based on being a woman.
With this band, no. Personally, I grew up with three older brothers, so I was definitely a tomboy most of my life. Just very used to, would you say, a more masculine atmosphere. And in these bands, I would say no, there's been no sexism. There was no hurdle that I had to get over, no stumbling blocks. And actually, I'm grateful to the band in general for having that not be an issue. Because, you know, if you look at the original Feelies, it was four guys. And I don't know if they ever thought, well, gee, can we have a woman in the band? Or did that even cross their minds? I don't know. It didn't, as far as I know. I think they were just looking for, members to really blend well together musically. And I don't think there was anything that was gender biased. And as far as, I think I might feel a little different in that I know that, you know, women often, whatever, we use the left side of the brain or the right side, I don't recall which it is, I might process things differently, and maybe that helps with the music, but I can't really say. So I'm aware that I might process things a little differently, like I might want to talk about, you know, the meaning of life, and the guys in the band would rather talk about, you know, what was on the cover of Mojo. But I think that's just more me rather than something that's gender based. Can't say that for the rest of the musical world because, you know, we all know that there are lots of stumbling blocks or you have to dress a certain way. You know, I was always able to just be myself. So it's not a clunky question. I'm sure there would be women in the music industry who might want to hear something positive about that the music is more important than the gender in the band.
Room 1. Everybody in this room is a folksy motherfucker, or a folksy bitch. Growing up in Radcliffe, Kentucky, population 20,000, I was not a folksy bitch and more in touch with small towns than with mountains, or with the farmer cousins I had an hour away. I watched cartoons and played Game Boy, didn't care about fiddles or banjos and rural music, old-time music, whatever. By the time I was 18, I knew I was going to go to the city and be a city bitch, a poet, a punk singer. So I did. I wasn't looking for the room of folksy motherfuckers and bitches because I knew folk was what I was leaving for those in the country and art was what I was becoming, frenzied and rhythmic in the city. I was comfortable with these definitions. I knew my culture. Room 2. Become what you are. It repeats like a self-help mantra in this room. But over these opaque minor chords, possibility is pretty sad sometimes. It's not unlocking your true potential, it's an ethics of becoming, as opposed to changing. Can't be that hard. Is the eternal poptimist jumping off point, right? Cue hospital bills and headaches, maybe due to voluntary surgery. The long debate about Ovid has been whether he wrote about transformation or about a deepening of the self in his metamorphoses. Someone is bestial, they physically become a beast to match their self. Is this change? Is this just progress? Become what you are. Can't be that hard. You break your bones to live how you would live. Room 1. The Feelies were not farmers any more than I. Pastoral meaning shepherd songs, they never made a pastoral. What did they feel stretching in that cornfield? If the central question of mythic America is space, what kind of space are they doing? 2 rooms. I wanted to get out of the space I grew up around, nervous at night in open areas. Small towns are not quite suburbs. But some people in both begin on the roof and sink down. I can picture and pose like anyone. Room is what takes place in a closed system, space in open country. Like neighborhood zoning versus topographical map. But both, of course, are subject to chart, chord chart. Natural was never rural, coded as it was in strum and hoot. Folksy codes make sweet peaches sweet. Room 2. There has got to be something queer in my chamber. Not my guitar, not my notebooks, at least not until I made them queer. Play like queer things for me, I tell them. Become what I am. So bored by ideas of individualness, finding no pleasure in ideas of individualness, I, in the words of poet Fred Moten, consent not to be a single being. This is very easy, surprisingly, against private years of struggle now over and public days of struggle that still catch me off guard. Poses, stances, this cell begs to be penetrated and tries out new singing voices. What gets me is a slant in a radio broadcast that looks like me. Room 3. Put your hands into folksy motherfuckers if you'll never be one. I put my queer hand into a folksy motherfucker. The transaction gives me room.
Peter Buck had already hit the mainstream with his band R.E.M. by the time he helped produce The Good Earth. How did he get in there with you, and how did it affect the recording of the record?
I keep a diary, and I was reading about the recording of The Good Earth. It started on Friday, January 2nd, 1986, and Peter Buck flew up from Athens, actually out of Atlanta, and I picked him. Well, I mean, we had met Peter. I especially met him several times because REM used to play at Maxwell's, even as late as 1984 when they were already playing like rather big theaters. They'd still play at Maxwell's, but it would be ungodly crowded to go in and see them. There'd always be a party afterwards upstairs at Steve Fallon's, and so that's where I met Peter Buck and Mike Mills. And I remember Peter Buck playing us a tape of Let It Be by The Replacements that he had played on. He always said, if the Feelies ever want to, he was a big fan of the Feelies. So when it came time when Glenn and Bill had come up with enough new songs, Steve Fallon, being a great friend of REM, arranged it so Peter could come up and assist in the production. I think a lot of it had to do with, like, Peter was supposed to, like, keep things moving, because otherwise things might take a long, Crazy Rhythms took a longer time than it should have, and Steve Fallon was aware of that, Peter would, you know, he'd know. He had a good ear, of course, you know, because REM had already recorded about 3 studio albums and were probably up working on their 4th by that time. So he had a little more experience in a big studio than the rest of us had had, that's for sure. Because I remember when we first set up for recording The Good Earth, like Stan and I set our, like we play live, you know, we set up, and then as soon as we started doing the basic tracks, Peter right away said, oh, well, you know, you can't play it like you do live, like it's getting too cluttered. We'll have Stan lay down a basic drum beat and Brenda do her bass. We'll do the percussion stuff last. You know, it made sense to me. I go, yeah, okay.
When it always came to producers, both Glenn and I always felt that we were more comfortable to have, like, another set of ears, you know, someone to, more as like a sounding board. You know, do you think that was a good take? What do you think of the tempo? There are a lot of times when you're working in a studio, we would tend to work like 18 hours, 20 hours at a clip, and it is easy to lose your perspective. So we always preferred to have just another set of ears in the room with us. Not that we needed to discuss arrangements or anything like that, but it was just like certain takes, maybe vocal takes where there might be a subtle difference, or a guitar take where there might be a subtle difference between takes. And so I think that's what we were looking for, and Peter was a perfect fit for that. He had no intention of coming in and saying, I'm Peter Buck, this is the way it's going to be, and he was already a fan of the band. He was thrilled to do it, and we were thrilled to have him. It was a good fit.
On The Good Earth, the vocals meld together very well with the instruments and the rhythms, as if they were intended to be another instrument instead of a lead vocal. Was this an intentional move on your part, and why?
Well, people had said that about Crazy Rhythms, too, that mixed the vocals kind of well. And I guess just the way it created a mood, more subdued, more acoustic guitar, wasn't really like a plan set out to do it. It just kind of turned out that way.
Was there a strong desire to make a record that was similar or even purposely different than your previously record, Crazy Rhythms, which had quite an underground impact on many bands throughout the 80s, yet left a 6-year gap and a lineup change between the two recordings? Is this specifically different from between that and Good Earth?
Like you mentioned, there's a lot of different reasons why it has a different sound. You know, lineup change. Definitely didn't want to repeat ourselves and do the same type of a record. Also, different influences. Did a tour across the country, playing all the small towns, college towns. Started to get interested in bands from around the country from, you know, those small college towns. I guess when Crazy Rhythms was written and recorded, it was more inspired and influenced by what was going on in New York. So that was a shift, I guess, away from New York toward, you know, Midwest and places like Athens, Georgia, and bands like the Meat Puppets from Arizona, and, you know, LA bands like Rain Parade, Dream Syndicate, like Minutemen, and, you know, Minneapolis, just, you know, a whole bunch of different things going on that probably had some influence there as well. So I guess it was basically the emergence of the college market, and colleges being important, the radio at the colleges, and places to play at the college. So I think that had something to do with it as well.
How does a drummer and also a percussionist communicate in constructing a song, rehearsing that song, and performing it on stage?
Well, with The Good Earth, I was pretty much told what to do. So, you know, and a lot of times even now, you know, I'm told what to do. But on the other hand, I pretty much know what to do. So I played consistently with Glenn since 1981. Because, I mean, even though I didn't play with Bill for, we didn't play with Bill for a long time, I pretty much continued playing with Glenn in various lineups and groups. You know, I think the song pretty much tells you what you got to play on it. But Glenn and Bill both have very definite ideas about drum and percussion parts as well. And whereas a lot of people really can't communicate those or they don't make sense, they're pretty good at doing so.
The feelings from the beginning seem so heavily percussion-driven. How does your bass playing fit into that equation?
It's really an instrument in that it is part of the rhythm section, but then it's melodic. You know, it's almost always melodic. So there are certain songs where doing something repetitive and just honing in on the rhythms and
not getting so caught up in melody would work better. And then there are other songs where it just seems like a blank canvas and you can just weave patterns and melodies around. Playing with Stan, you really latch on to those rhythms, and that's something that's important, is listen to the drummer and hone in on what's happening there and try to make them work together.
The front cover was shot in a cornfield in Illinois. And it was originally intended to be a color photo because I don't know, are you familiar with like Terrence Malick? Well, he would do these like scenes like in his early work where you'd just see like, you know, the whole upper part of the screen would be really beautiful blue sky and the bottom might be this like wheat field of color, like, you know, like this sort of golden color. And that's what it looked like when you're driving by this corn in the sky, and this would be a great place we should stop and stick a photo, like a memento of this tour.
On a site called the Feelies Web, it stated the band didn't like touring. Why so? And does this affect, does this affect performing in general? Because it always, to me, sounds great to me. Like when I saw you live, I thought it was even better than the record. So do you differentiate between touring and just playing a live show?
Well, yeah, because touring involves, show after show, night after night. And, just being away and not getting much sleep and eating bad. Basically, you want each show to be really great, special, as best it could be, and just the nature of being on the road, kind of, you know, that those two things kind of clash often.
It seems universal that this band just does not prefer touring.
No, I the saying, be careful what you wish for. Well, you know, I always wanted to be a drummer when I was a kid, and, you know, I got to do it, and almost as soon as I started playing in bars, I knew, boy, this is really not very nice. But now, you know, we pretty much handpick what we do. We do get some pretty nice offers. We're usually treated pretty well. In general, we play really nice places. Even, like, the one place that we played recently that was kind of a dump, I mean, they were really nice to us, and it sounded good on stage, and we had a, you know, if it wasn't sold out, it was close to it, so...
All the feelings I've talked to, it seems almost universal that no one really enjoyed touring. Is that true? And if so, what is it about it?
Well, the Feelies, we enjoyed aspects of touring, but you know, we didn't like to go too far. And I think like experience of going to Europe, like we didn't know much about. Yeah, you know, we went to Europe in November. We didn't think ahead, though, like, it's going to be, like, the weather is going to be nightmarish, and then you get over there, and, like, the clubs are little unheated places, and so that turned us off to traveling to Europe. Yeah, we enjoyed our little motorhome jaunts through the Midwest and up to New England, and we used to like going down south and playing in Georgia and South Carolina, because of R.E.M. and the B-52s and bands that came from the South, you always had a huge following of college people that liked that kind of music.
Were you a social type? Did you like talking to the audience and going to things afterwards?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, I like meeting people. That's why I like touring, because every night's a new experience in a new town. But I like to hang out. I don't like to just go to the town and then leave. I like to soak up the atmosphere of a place. But you can't always do that when you play. You know, it's like, you know, next day you got a, you know, 400 or 500 mile drive. And a lot of times fans, they don't understand that, whoa, why can't you come to our party? You know, like, no, because I got to go to bed, you know.
Does journalism or audience wants or needs ultimately affect how you perform and write?
No, not how we write. I can see it in
perhaps like in a live setting. I think it's something like, there was a term that one of my sons used, and it was mutually symbiotic, and I think that that's probably would be it. I think if the crowd is, there's like an exchange going on between an audience and a band performing live, and sometimes that works very well together, or, you know, from my perspective. I don't think it really enters into writing at all, or recording, but live it is, because you're part of this bigger thing. It's not just a band playing. It's everybody that's in the room.
I'm always caught in the middle of that. I write a lot about it, how I love the sense of home, but I also like being on the road.
Well, it's like Tom Verlaine says, the travel fulfills you, the distance fulfills you.
Between Good Earth and the next record, Only Life, the Feelies ended up on a major label, A&M. Was this a difficult transition for the band?
No, actually not at all, because it was, it wasn't, as you described, it really was a little bit different. Coyote Records, which was owned by Steve Fallon, who I mentioned earlier was our manager, that's the label that put out the Good Earth. And actually, that was another, you know, I didn't mention it before, but one of the big driving forces behind making the Good Earth, and it's kind of like a lesson that we learned from Crazy Rhythms, was take, you know, a number of giant steps backwards. We were working with Steve, who was a friend because he, you know, he owned Maxwell's and we'd play there. And so it was this like friendly sort of relationship we had in making the Good Earth. He wanted to do more with Coyote Records and get better distribution and put the bands that were on Coyote a little bit out there and have a little bit more exposure. So he had entered into an agreement with A&M Records. A&M Records always had the reputation. It was a major label, but it was kind of still more like, I guess, what some would call like a boutique label, more like an artist-oriented label. A lot of the people that worked at A&M were fans of the band. They knew the band from New York, and we knew them. So even though they were based in Los Angeles, their New York office was already very familiar with the band. So it really was a good fit. There wasn't a lot of like pressure to come up with hit songs or do remixes or, you know, anything like that. And I think the band was still more closely tied to Coyote than A&M. Now, that all kind of shifted when A&M was purchased by Universal. Then all the people that knew the band had left, and then it just became another giant black hole.
I knew Beatles were a big influence. You covered a couple of the songs, and you can tell that you have that sort of the mainstream appeal, or you grew up with that. But yet the band does have an underground or alternative feel, if you want to use that word. What causes that shift instead of more of a poppy mainstream sound?
Probably the way we go about arranging our music. I think we'd probably drop a chorus before we'd add a chorus, and we put less into what we do arrangement-wise and, you know, than I guess what like a pop band would do, although we've been called a pop band, so who knows? I guess it depends who you're talking to. But we don't really think about it that much in terms of how we fit in or how we relate to other music prior or of our time. And we do what we do. And that's, you know, that's what appeals to us as musicians. And we've been fortunate that it appeals to other people as well. So, I mean, when we get together to play, that's kind of how we started out. It was in my basement, and, you know, some people get together and play cards or go bowl. We got together and played music.
You know, it's only natural to face a lot of opposition, and that kind of strengthens your vision.
So do you think that's sort of a defensive sort of mechanism in your style, I guess?
Well, I think if anything in the style, it's really the dichotomy of the not wanting to be ignored but not wanting to have a lot of attention. Those things kind of simultaneously coexist.
The Feelies were very influenced by the Velvet Underground and Jonathan Richman and the Modern Lovers, and if you listen to those records, it's just very propulsive kind of rhythm. You know, there's no room to, like, it's not like Led Zeppelin kind of music or The Who or something like that. It's just very steady. But by the time of The Good Earth, that became a signature of the Feelies sound itself.
There's not a lot of time to fool around. When we get together, pretty much crank out the songs and, you know, rehearse and do exactly what we got to do. When I first started playing with Bill, Glenn, and Dave, we used to jam a lot more. And even over the years, we used to jam we just don't have the time to now. I like playing in the studio, too. It's just that, you know, it's a lot different world with recording now. You know, I mean, you used to have studios. There aren't so many of them anymore. And, you know, like, you know, home recording has pretty much taken over. I'm fine with recording, but my favorite thing is just to, you know, play music with my friends, really.
Being in a band with people that long, how does that work as, like, business versus friends? Do you consider yourself still friends? Do you actually go out as friends? Or how does the band function in that way?
That's an interesting question. It's kind of like kids playing in a sandbox. You'd have a bunch of toddlers maybe playing in a sandbox. They're all kind of doing their own thing, but they're very near each other, and they're probably aware of each other, but they're also kind of keeping to themselves. I think that's sort of how we live our lives. Like, we're all friends, and we care for each other, and, you know, there are a lot of memories and ties to each other, but, like, to, you know, go out to the movies together or something like that, we just don't do that, and that's kind of hard to picture. It might sound a little strange because, like, when you tour, you're together, you know, practically 24/7. So there are many, many times of just silence, you know, not a bad silence, but just being near each other, but not actually talking. I think we talk through our music. It's sometimes easier to just play a song than to think of something to say.
I have been listening to the Feelies since the day I began buying music. Until the conception of this podcast, I had never talked to any of the Feelies. Contacting them is a debt owed to my friend Jim Testa, his friend Howard Wolfling, and also to the Feelies drummer himself, Stan Demeski. I'd also like to thank the writers on today's program. We had track 2, The High Road, which was done by Jim Testa, track 5, which was When Company Comes, done by Jim DeRogatis. Track 6 was Let's Go by Edmund O'Brien. And lastly, track 7, Two Rooms, was done by Audrey Z. Whitesides. Thank you once again for listening to episode 7 of Jughead's Basement, featuring my favorite band, the Feelies, and their record, The Good Earth. Stay tuned next time, in a few weeks, when me and my co-host, Dan Vapid, of many bands, Dan Vapid and the Cheats, The Methadones, Riverdales, Screeching Weasel, Queers, he and I will be featuring Naked Ray Gun's Throb Throb. And we, in fact, have interviews with every single member of the band, and also a special interview with Steve Albini. Stay tuned.
With 50,000 watts of power, we go by faster miles an hour with the radio on. Road runner, road runner. Going faster miles an hour. I'm gonna drive by the Stop and Shop with the radio on. See, I'm in love with the modern world, Massachusetts when it's late at night, and the neon when it's cold outside. See, I have the radio on like a runner. Now what do you think about that, you guys?
Radio on.
Good, we got the AM.
Thank you for listening to Jughead's Basement. Make sure to check out the other shows on the TNH Network right here at TuesdayNightHoot.com.